Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming out on this rainy day. Believe it or not, HSP is hoping for the weather to stay in the 40s and 50s for the next 3 weeks as we get the compressor for our chiller fixed. So if it gets too nice, boo. My name is Paige Talbot, and I'm the president of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. We're delighted to welcome so many here tonight. How many of you have never been to the Historical Society before? Well, it's wonderful that you've joined us, and I hope that you will return to other programs, including those in this series. We want to welcome you to the first of three events. Many of you have seen, Karen, you want to hold up the brochure that was out at the front desk, and there are two more of these programs, one in May and one in June. These are part of what we call our Artist Embedded series. And the programs and the entire Artist Embedded program at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania has been made possible by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. And we're very, very grateful for that. By the way, the artist who is embedded is Ain Gordon down here at the end. Writing in 1797, William Godwin insisted, "Nothing is more uncertain, more contradictory, more unsatisfactory than the evidence of facts." And more than two centuries later, historian Jill Lepore wrote, "Every history is incomplete. Every historian has a point of view. Every historian relies on what is unreliable. Documents written by people who are not under oath and cannot be cross-examined." Tonight, our topic is voicing the absent, crafting history. We have asked historian Jane Kamensky, filmmaker Louis Messiah, and playwright Ain Gordon to discuss their views on how to represent history when so little is actually known about how people felt or thought. Where does fact end and fiction begin? How do we fill in the gaps? Ain, would you like to give us some thoughts? Jane.
Is this on? Hi, so I'm Jane Kamensky, and I'm the robe-wearing historian in the group. I'm neither an artist nor embedded, and very happy to be in this sort of fruitfully mixed company of people who go after the past in different ways. I think that the reason Paige and her team asked me is because I'm a historian who has written a novel. Jill Lepore and I co-wrote a novel called Blind Spot that was set in 1764 and that was interested, among other questions, in exploring what it meant to give voice to people from long ago as fiction writers who were historians. But in my day job, I teach history at Brown University, and I'm working on a biography of the painter John Singleton Copley right now, which has had me doing little bits and pieces of research at HSP because Copley had a near double in Pennsylvania's native son, Benjamin West. I should say in these brief remarks that I really like gaps. It's one of the reason I'm a historian of the 1600s and 1700s rather than, say, the post-1945 era. I have a colleague who's a modern American historian who jokes that he's always hoping that some archive might have a fire, while I'm hoping that some random piece of paper will be discovered. So I work in a period of American history where relatively little survives, where literacy was less than universal and was doled out unequally, right? So fewer women than men, fewer people could write than could read, fewer women than men could write, fewer non-whites than whites could write, and in some places true by law because writing was a kind of power. So the record that I inherit and that I work in as a historian is riddled with holes. If you think of those ancient vases that are put together in ways that you can see the stuff that was created rather than the stuff that was found, there's a lot of blank space in the record that people like me work in. And I kind of like that. I like the puzzles. I like thinking about what's not there. And look forward to talking to Ayn and Louis about the moments when we come up against the limits of our evidence and try in various ways to imagine what it would be like to transcend them, or to stop and say, this is a place that that we don't and can't know, and here's why. I'll give one brief example of a kind of gap that I'm wrestling with now, and then I'll make a really short plea for a different kind of knowledge than archival knowledge. So in my biography of Copley, he's a wonderful character, and after I wrote this novel with Joe Lepore, I began to think of my historical actors as characters in narratives in somewhat different ways. One of the reasons he's a wonderful character is because he not only painted so vividly, but he left a lot of letters. He has the kind of social position that allows us to see what he thought, or at least what he said he thought. He also is advantaged as a historical subject by having grown up in a time of war which scattered his family for long periods. People who are far apart write to people who are far apart and are the kind of people who can write to each other. So there's a tremendous amount, hundreds of very disclosing letters back and forth between him and his wife, him and his brother, him and his mother, at precisely the moments that a historian might want to shine light on the 18th century, 1774, after the Boston Tea Party, say. But then the family gets back together. It all works out pretty well for them. They get back together in late 1775, early 1776, and they go dark. The record goes dark. He's very visible from the outside, because newspapers, art critics, people who are patrons of this artist begin to write about him. But we never hear from him again in his life for 40 years. The women begin to talk back and forth after there's a redispersal. So that's something that I'm really wrestling with in a biography that treats him from about the age of 6 to about the age of near 80 when he dies, is what does one do narratively when the record goes dark like that? And we've all come up against it from different ways. The last thing I'll say is that I think historians have a habit, and many other researchers who work with archives have a habit, where we feel like we have to find a piece of paper to say anything, preferably 5 or 6. So there are ways of knowing that we have as human beings that we employ when we walk into a room and I try to get a sense of who you are, sir, that we might shut off as researchers because we've trained ourselves not to ask, what was this guy like? Or what was it like to be this woman? Or wasn't it really cold then? Or, gee, weren't they eating rotten food? And did that mean they were in pain all the time? So I'm interested in talking with you about ways of knowing that are legitimate and factual, humanistically, if not archivally, and what we can do to turn on that faculty of empathy without denying that people were different from us in different places and time and different from each other, too.
You want me to go? Yeah. So I grew up, my mother's family is British, and they were stayed there, and my father is a New York Jew, third generation, and I grew up surrounded by old people. And I was deposited regularly with each group of old people for extended amounts of time, and there were no children around ever. And my elders, these elders, both in England and in New York, didn't do anything. In England, they didn't have a television. They only had a radio, and they listened to it almost never. So we basically sat around. And in New York, I got deposited usually on Friday, and that meant that sundown we couldn't turn on the lights or write or read or watch TV or listen to the radio or do anything. So there was nothing to do except talk. And I was a resourceful kid. I'm talking about being like 8 years old. And I started to say, tell me a story about yourself. And so they would tell me stories about themselves, and over time the stories would begin to contradict. And I learned that history was not reliable, and that they believed absolutely what they told me every time, even though it was not the same as what they told me last time. And soon my grandparents kind of multiplied into cubist self-portraits to me, many-faced people. And inside them were the sort of younger, taller, more lustful, more dangerous people they had been, which were very enticing to me. And I began to then kind of interrogate the stories and say, but wait a minute, last time you said that so-and-so was there. Oh, well, that was when she was married to blah, blah. Wait a minute, you said she was not married. What do you mean married? Who was she married to? And I would get these facts out of them and slowly accumulate them, and then I would go back to my father or my mother and say, did you know that she was married to a gangster and he shot at the house? And no, I knew none of that. So there were the people who were closer to the history and knew nothing about it at all, and there were the people who lived the history who were telling me a different story every time. And I became a lover of that. And I, as soon as a narrative asserts itself and asserts its truth, I either lose interest or question it. And I look, therefore, always for the broken narrative. What is missing? Because in the missing is the information usually I require. Also, as a person who makes, therefore, theater out of these lives, I do need to feel required, which means that if the history is complete enough, as it presents itself, then very likely I will walk away and not use it. I am looking for a necessity for somebody to pay attention to something that is not being paid attention to anymore, probably because it's not complete enough to entice most visitors. That's sort of my place. I have worked often in the 19th century. I do love working with the stories of dead people because there's a kind of fixed amount available. And I'm very attracted to, I look for the fragment that is both enticing enough to get me going and both absent enough to give me permission. And that's harder the closer you get to the present moment. Although I am now trying to force myself to reckon with the present moment, or a moment we don't call history yet.
Hi. So I'm assuming that we're all here because of a certain relationship that we have with history, and that we honor history and value history. And also, when we think about it, we realize that there's this power in history. My name is Louis Messiah. I'm a documentary filmmaker. And in many ways, when you're working with documentary film, it's all historical because you're working with materials that you've captured, and it's already passed. And you then are in the process of reconstructing it and presenting it to share. As a documentary filmmaker, I'm very aware that what I'm doing is part of a discourse. It's part of when I'm making a film, I'm not making a film just for someone to look at and consume and forget. I'm really hoping my deepest aspiration is that it's the beginning of a kind of conversation. That it's I've had the luxury of working and researching something for a good period of time and can put it out in a kind of articulate way, and then audience that in the best of all worlds I have some way of interacting with, either hopefully live, and if not live, through some sort of electronic means, that it's a discourse takes place. And it's a discourse that I'm one pole in the discourse, and that the discourse also happens with between people that have seen the work. One of the things that I'm very much aware of that in working with documentary is that it's in working with documents, it's how you put things together. So the gaps are very much in the nature of things because you're working with these discrete actualities, these discrete artifacts that you've either captured or have gained from some sort of archive, and then you're putting them together, and the gaps are sort of artificially erased by the proximity of putting footage together and sort of editing it together into some sort of coherent story. So a lot of the work of a filmmaker, and a filmmaker that is particularly interested in presenting history, is really the structure, and that's really where the work is oftentimes. How do you construct, and I don't even say reconstruct, how do you construct this material in a way that somehow gives a sense of what has happened and what has passed? I actually began making documentaries and historical documentaries not necessarily having studied historical documentaries, not necessarily that there was some guru of historical documentary filmmaking that I sort of sat down at her or his feet and said, how do you do it? And so I sort of created the work and then sort of figured out, well, that's working and that's not working. But I think, in working with people that had been wrestling with history, you begin to learn how people put work together, and certainly narrative becomes this very, very, very important tool of the documentary historian. And narrative's important because, narrative, storytelling crosses cultures. Yes, there are particular narrative forms that develop in certain economies. Hollywood has a sets of narratives that it develops. Narratives develop in Native American cultures. Narratives develop in African cultures, in Northern European cultures. I mean, there are different forms of narratives, but narrative sort of as a structure, that is, the emotional engagement with subject, is something that crosses cultures. And so oftentimes as filmmakers, we rely on narrative as a way of presenting the material. So then that sort of raises all these other issues, because sometimes what you're aware of is that narrative is not necessarily history. So let's go to a specific example. So I said I didn't really have gurus, but I think the first time that I worked with a group of filmmakers that were deeply enmeshed in really thinking about history and how you present history was when I was working on a series that was looking at the civil rights and black liberation struggle, a series called Eyes on the Prize, where I was working on the second series that was looking at the Northern struggle. And at working with the team, this was a series that was being done in Boston. It was executive produced by a man named Henry Hampton. Really realizing the power of this, the way that the series was going to succeed is that if people could have an emotional connection. And so narrative became extraordinarily important. But narrative also means that you, as it develops, sometimes one has to, you have to be aware of what kind of narrative form that you're working in. I said that there are many different sort of cultural forms of narrative. And if your narrative says that it's going to be about a single individual, which is often the way narrative works, facing some kind of adversary or some kind of conflict and some sort of, and that there's going to be some kind of resolution, that may not in fact be serving history, in that maybe it's not about a great individual, and maybe it's, there's not a clear villain, and maybe it's more complex. But the other side of it is that if you're making this work because you want it to be part of a discourse and you want people to be engaged in it, and you know that narrative is sort of in our DNA, that we really we relate to narrative. If you work in a more maybe essayistic kind of form, you may not reach as many people. So there's that trade-off with how you structure things and present things, and how can you find a narrative structure, or how can you find a structure that engages audience but doesn't eat at the facts. So, anyway, so my gap struggle and my is really one about structure, and as I, work on work, it's that's really important. The other thing is that I just wanted to say, it's sort of another kind of energy is realizing that I found tremendous power from oral history and community histories. That is, histories that aren't necessarily based on fact. And sometimes they're based on those contradictions that Ayn was referring to, these, the cubist perspective coming from the community. And sometimes if you acknowledge that multiple facets to things, it sometimes is a way, it can illuminate, it can bring about a greater understanding. So I'll stop there.
Do you have something you want to say? So you've all talked about gaps, but I'm wondering, are there some gaps that don't want to be filled? Are there times when silence should remain? And how do we deal with the essential sounds of the period and the rhythms of how people communicate?
I'll just say about the silence. The metaphor you brought up about the vase with the pieces showing where the absent pieces are, I actually used that metaphor in a play It was funny that you said it. And in a lot of ways, I feel like that is what I do. I feel like I am the Lucite box, and I am always trying to put the Lucite box over a broken something and say the pieces that are here are interesting enough. And I do worry about filling in too many of the other pieces and it not being clear to the audience that the pieces, you know, when you see those vases, the piece that they put in is usually sort of neutral colored so that you know it's put in. And I wonder, I often try to build something into a piece of theater that destabilizes the authority of the play a little bit so that the audience is reminded not to buy this whole cloth, reminded that I am positing that maybe this is how this took place, but I am not telling you that I know, and we do not know, and part of what I hope you can attach to is perhaps the tragedy that we can't know. Could that be as much of an emotional through line as the story itself? Which is that's a hard double bind. Yeah.
Which reminds me of just a project that I have been working on for a long time is about Haiti and the United States, and so I've done a lot of work, but it's still far from anywhere near presentable or shareable. I guess last year I went to a Haitian studies conference in Haiti. So this was maybe, I guess, whatever, 3 years or 4 years. I forget when the earthquake was. And a group of art historians from Yale had come to make this presentation. Apparently in the 1890s, a wealthy Haitian merchant had commissioned portraits of Haitian presidents from the first leader, Toussaint Louverture, to whatever president was in the 1890s. And it was shipped to, I guess, some sort of world exposition in New Orleans. This material somehow wound its way up to Yale and was in some of them were in really, really horrible shape. They were not well cared for. You know, the paintings had been stored face to face, and some paint from one canvas went to the other. And there are like maybe 20 canvases. And one of the art historians had said, what we're going to do is we're going to clean them up and we're going to present them so how they originally looked. And there was a doctoral student there who said, no, I think it's important that we show how badly this work has been treated. I think it's important that we talk about the gaps and that we talk about the silences, that we talk about the distortions, and that there's energy in the fact that we don't have the 40 years. There's energy that we have little on because people weren't allowed to write. We need to talk about that. And as opposed to trying to fill it in, we need to acknowledge that. And there's actually power in that. So
this this metaphor of ceramics conservation is a really good one. And it's worth saying that it used to be the practice up till about 1960 that when you were recreating an old vase, you'd make it look like what you thought it looked like in, you know, 600 BC. So that those practices changed just as our narrative practices have changed and become more porous and with different kinds of authenticity. I tend to be of about five minds on this question because on one side of a line, there's the problem of presumption, right? How dare you say this is what it looked like? How dare you fill it in? On the other end of that line, there's the problem with there's a problem of abdication. You've done all this work. You have more authority than anybody else who's ever worked on this subject, and you won't give a compelling, singular narrative that says, "I think it was like this." And I think that's the rock and the hard place that we navigate. So on the one hand, I'm enormously compelled by this new method of conservation. There's an installation at Harvard right now that's a series of large Mark Rothko murals that were destroyed by being hung in sunlight with food flung at them. And the kind of conservation they've done is a pixel by pixel digital projection where the unrestored murals are hanging and they're filled in with light. And at 4 o'clock every day, you turn it off. And you can see what the light is doing. You can step in front of it. You can have both the recreated object and the gap. That's kind of neat, because I think without the recreation, there are things that we forget. So to stay with the ancient statuary metaphor, we forget that these things were painted and that people lived in color. You know, we forget that the Venus had arms. I don't want to prescribe. I want to say there's a tension there, and I'll offer one free association that I was thinking about when Ayn and Louis were talking. When my older son, who's now 16, was about 4, big developmental stage for thinking about life and death. Right? He said, "What happens when we die?" And I gave the unpainted vase answer. I said, well, you know, different people believe different things. You know, the Catholics believe that there's a kind of heaven where you rejoin your family, and the Jews believe that there might be some kind of afterlife, but it's not, you know, a fully developed theological thing, and, you know, other, you know, Quakers say this, and he listened very attentively, and then he said, okay, what do we believe? And that was a real stumper, right? And I think that is an audience's question oftentimes to a narrative that calls attention to its constructedness. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, okay, Ayn, okay, Louis, okay, Jane, what do you believe? I've been trying to have it both ways on the page and say sometimes it could have been this, it could have been that, it could have been this. I think it's this. I don't know if that's satisfying to a reader. I guess we must all have narrative styles that are bugbears, right? And mine, for all his talent and eminence and diligence, is David McCullough, who sits up there in the ether and compels us with those blue eyes and lulls us along with generally very comforting, you know, single perspective histories told from great height. On the other hand, he knows how to hold a reader. And I wonder if there's a way to do both of those things.
I'm wondering for any and all of you if there's we'll call it a never go there line. When you're telling these stories, when you're filling in the gaps, for example, does anachronism ever have a legitimate place? Can you mislead your audience in a way that's irresponsible? Can the facts be right, but the whole sensibility be wrong?
My no-go zone, I mean, yeah, I have definitely feelings about factuality and non-factuality, but my no-go zone is pretty emotional. We talked a little bit about this on the phone. Because I feel that I am using people, that is the word that I use all the time about it. Because I feel that I'm using them, I feel that I have to, I feel, A, this thing about feeling I must be required so I can offer something back. B, that there should be something I can give them in return for the use. Now, this is completely, you know, this is heebie-jeebie. Most of them are dead. But there's something I have to feel like I have framed them for a moment in a way they wouldn't get otherwise. And so that's part of the contract I make with these dead people. And it is pretty emotional, and I have real decisions about I know this thing about them, and that would really, really work on stage. And I don't think, unless I'm going to tell all these things, I can't tell this thing, because that's what everybody's going to walk away with. So it's a very personal decision about if I'm presenting something balanced, if I'm doing justice to them, even if they are a bad guy. What are the complications of how they were bad? You know, a lot of times they were just people of their time, and the time had much badness in it. Right, but how can I frame them so that we can say, this is not okay, but everybody was doing it? You know, I once wrote about Robert Moses, the guy who bulldozed and also built the New York that we rely on incredibly to this day. No one could get from one side of New York to the other without what he did, and he did horrifying things. And everyone is all about how terrible he was. He was a man of his time. He built more public parks than anyone has before or since in the history of New York. He also built horrible housing projects. He was that man. So how can you put all of that out so that we don't just say, walk away with the neat gravestone?
So that makes me want to ask about archetypes. As we look back at history, there are the good and the bad and the ugly. But oftentimes those characteristics are arrived at through reduction. And is it right that people who can't fight back get words put in their mouth?
So just playing off of something Ayn said, we don't give funeral sermons. Right, it's I think what all of us do in different ways is more like an autopsy than a funeral sermon. So there's ugliness beside and beneath beauty all the time. I think, you know, back to Paige's question about what the sort of red lines or no-go zones are. As a historian, I like to believe that I don't knowingly lie. But I might not tell the whole truth, and I might not tell it all at once. I might dole it out in ways that I would hope get us to a more fully rounded person instead of a paper doll. This feels particularly urgent to me as a historian of the period of the American Revolution, because I feel like all we have are paper dolls that sort of, you know, move in their 18th century ways and... this is another thing we could talk about. Who is our we? My sons again will say, we really gave it to those British in the American. It's like, really? Your people were eating dirt in Ireland and Czechoslovakia. We did that. So the roundedness seems particularly important. And I like to believe that a more rounded narrative of that national origins story might allow us to think in more complex ways about the ways that there's good and bad, even right now. So if that sometimes means titrating truths so that a reader thinks in light and sometimes and in shadow and other times.
To me, that's part of the if you are thinking you want someone to know this about this person, then you are trying to hook them. So then there is the moral tug of war of, like, what is the narrative structure, back to your original introduction, what is the narrative structure that will keep people as interested as I already am? And sometimes that is gamesmanship.
Yeah. Although, I'm thinking when I've worked on films that have dealt with individuals as opposed to communities, I'm I have, and I've changed. My red line has shifted over the years, I must say. I have been somewhat hesitant to get into people's personal lives, and if I can't really see how someone's personal life, sexuality, sexual appetite has anything to do, or alcohol consumption has anything to do with the work, I'm not going to put it there, even though that may actually make it more attractive to some people. Because I also, going back to this history is power thing, is that I see this as cultural work that I'm doing, and cultural work in meaning how can we strengthen communities? How can we give ourselves the foundation and an analysis to go to a next step? So if part of what I'm trying to do is this cultural work, I'm not going to titillate if it's going to also undermine the foundation, particularly if I don't think, if there's no particular use for that. But the other side is, if I do think that someone's personal life has everything to do with their power, it's not a question. It's going to be there. I was thinking of another red line that happens only in the times when I have worked more narratively outside of the documentary realm, and or historically, and you have to make assumptions about the past and how people for film, how people look, how people dress. I'm just thinking, and this is like a really particular thing, about speech of African Americans. And some would say, well, if you're making a work in a particular time, you should use dialect. Even though we don't know what people sounded like, we should use dialect. And I said, well, explain to me what you mean by dialect. And unless somebody can prove to me without any kind of question, this is what people sounded like at a particular time, I'm not going to use it because it has other resonances and, again, kind of, I think, destroys a kind of credibility I'm trying to build.
And I think there's also the rules of your... the aesthetic rules of your practice. I mean, I often won't use a dialect because I think it's hokey. It signals hokey theater to me. So I would rather not. I will get rid of contractions if we're going to a certain period because they didn't use them in writing that I can see most of the time. And to give a sort of sense of the importance of words, but I will not often, you know, it just feels hokey.
I wonder what you all think about viewpoint. In this organization, we've had some interesting conversations about words like interpretation, curation, viewpoint, because as a nonprofit 501c3, we can't take a political stance. But that's a very different thing than having a viewpoint in terms of historical narrative. My question is, do you need to have a viewpoint to communicate meaning in the story and or in order for it to be an engaging story?
So I think if any of you out there doesn't have a point of view, you're quite unlike anyone I've ever met. And I guess one of the things that historians want people to learn to do is to think in time, which means realizing that we're products of our time too. So there's viewpoint in the sense of what's a no-go zone for a nonprofit, which is, I think, you can't be making your own cardboard cutouts and using them to beat on somebody else's cardboard cutouts. I was flashing while Paige was talking a story a graduate student told me who had interviewed for a job at a small liberal arts Christian college in Vermont or New Hampshire, and the college had said, "What do you think of Thomas Jefferson?" And she said, "You know, Thomas Jefferson was a complicated man, you know, the founder of American liberties, who was himself a slaveholder, you know, who had a half-enslaved family." And interviewer stopped and said, "We here at St. Michael's have the following take on Thomas Jefferson." I think that kind of institutional viewpoint almost always does violence. But you know, we have the viewpoints of ourselves and also to a certain extent of our times, right? There's a reason that I care about family and household stories, and you're working on stories of gay, lesbian, transgender people, and you're recovering the African-American past. It's because those struggles have become urgently important to us in the late 20th and early 21st century in ways that would have been utterly mystifying to people in 1775.
I agree. There is no such thing as no point of view. And one of the things that I'm always trying to say in every work I've ever made and every time I ever teach and every time I ever encounter younger people who tell me that history is boring is that history was kept with a point of view. It comes to you point of viewed. There is no clean fact being offered you. Somebody chose to remember this and not to remember that. Somebody wrote down this thing on this day when they had a bad breakfast before they wrote it down, so they were grumpy when they wrote down these set of facts. There was always a point of view. It is all point of viewed. And in relation to the no-go zone and the point of view and the moral compass, I also think that when you do find yourself looking into some historical cache for inspiration, you have to be very frank with yourself about why you are there. What do you want? What is turning you on about this information? What is your personal investment? How much is, like every play, this actually about you? And what part of you is buried in this story?
There's a screening that will be happening, I'm not connected with. There's a screening that's going to be happening this Saturday at the Wagner Free Institute in North Philadelphia at 17th and Montgomery. And what they will be showing, it's a repeat showing because the first time they showed it, it was so much, whatever, energy, sort of like critical energy that came about. This is news footage of North Philadelphia shot by, unedited news footage that was shot by the three commercial stations that are part of the Urban Archive at Temple University. And it's looking at, it's news footage of the uprisings in 1964, of life on the street, and it's just lots and lots of footage. And I think when they first decided to show the footage, they thought this is going to be quite wonderful. This will be a chance for people in the community to come and look at what North Philadelphia looked like at that time. But what I don't think had gone into their thinking was that those cameras all have a perspective. The news camera is not the same as as a home movie camera. It's not the same as the Instamatic photograph that somebody takes. I mean, so where you place the camera, everything has a perspective, and you go with that, and you acknowledge that, and you use that, and in terms of how you structure things. But if you can't. And also, if you can let the audience know what that perspective is, that also is part of the joy and the information sharing and in the presenting of history.
I think that acknowledging there's a point of view doesn't mean it's all turtles all the way down. So students have a habit these days of saying, "I feel that." You know, no. No, I mean, that, sure, that, but that's not enough, right? There's more and less knowable, there's better and worse. So that acknowledging that there's a person behind that camera and they're pointing it some particular way doesn't mean that everything is endlessly perspectival and we can know nothing. And I think in this age where the fragmentation of knowledge is very, very accepted by young people, there can be a level of skepticism around point of view that is so radical that it's corrosive.
We're going to take a few questions from the audience, but before we do, I did want to, I guess, sort of put in a plug, which is to ask you how collections such as those here at the Historical Society can inform the kind of work that each of you does. What does research look like for the historian, the novelist, the playwright, the filmmaker? What kinds of sources do you find the most exciting and that really feed your passion?
So I'm a little bit of a problem because I don't respond to digitized collections at all, which is just, it's an interesting thing because in some of the research when I was doing a previous play that I researched here, everybody kept saying, but it's all digital, you can get it online, and I kept saying that doesn't work for me. I need to have the paper in my hand or the object in my hand. It's very emotional for me, and the little shreds matter, and the digital thing equalizes everything. It becomes the same size, it becomes the same light quality, it becomes the same equal object, and I start to have a bland experience, and I start to go away, kind of like this lighting. And so I need to have my hands on it. And what I love that there is a lot of here is pretty unfiltered collection, which is to say as much as there is relating to that is what they have. And that it is, like I did the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society minutes. They have, I think, 50 years worth of minutes. They are chronological. But otherwise, they are not at all separated by ones in which important things happen and ones in which unimportant things happen. And that, for me, is crucial. If it's all been done, then I will actually probably turn away once again and decide I'm not of use. It needs to be filtered, or I will go away from it. So those kinds of collections are vital to me. There are a whole lot of them here, and the fact that no one wants to talk to me about them while I'm looking at them is vital. I don't like a guide. If I have a guide, I will also usually turn away. I like a guide later, when I know enough to ask very pointed questions, but not at the outset. At the outset, then I will receive the story that is receivable, that most people have received, which has therefore been promulgated. And I want the story that isn't doing that.
So I want to invite Ayn to come to the 17th century, right? Like that experience of manuscript and of handedness, I think is really thrilling to someone like me. So there's a Benjamin West sketchbook that HSP has. He was 18 at the time he did it. And sketching even more than painting just shows the hand behind the artifact. I find that very thrilling and irreplaceable with the digital. I like things that are falling apart in those ways. I also like, as a historian, thinking about how a collection gets made. So with the Copley letters, there are about 1,000 letters among the family, and they're in three places. They're in the Public Records Office in England, they're in the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston, and they're in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. And you could just go and pillage all those things without really much thinking how they came there. Libraries don't usually keep what museums would call provenance information. The more I started thinking about this, the more I realized there's a gender narrative and a political narrative. So the gender narrative is the stuff that landed in America, the women's stuff went to the local, and the great man's stuff went to the national. So if Copley signed it, it's probably at the Library of Congress. If it's just lovely chattering letters among wives and sisters that tell us what's really going on, it's at the Mass Historical. And it's only there because the women were the custodians of memory. They gave it to the Library of Congress because they, too, shared this gender hierarchy of knowledge. If it's at the Public Record Office in London, that's because it was the revolution and somebody seized it. So those the stories behind an archive, I think, can often be as revealing as the archive itself.
There's a term in documentary filmmaking when you use archival footage, and you use archival footage or archival materials in a kind of generic way, which is wallpaper. So let's say you say in 1903 there were plans for a new subway system in Philadelphia, and you show images of plans from 1911. And so it's basically, it's a placeholder that, and I should say Ken Burns is the master of wallpaper. He's many times he's exact, but a lot of times he's not. The Civil War is just filled with sort of
pictures
that are not accurate. What I find most valuable about archives are the archivist who, if the librarian is a sharing, giving person who's in love with the material and can inform that image that I find, and therefore I can use that image in a way that is intelligent, and I can share that. And so therefore, knowing who's in that image, it helps me in my storytelling. Truth really is like the ultimate way of when the closer you get to the truth, the more power you have. So it's really the archivist who knows, even beyond provenance, but who knows what it means, who knows what's there. That's why collections like this and archives are so important.
That's great. Craig, do you want to use the mic?
So what about the audience? You've kind of talked about your own, your writing, your filmmaking, your playing. But what about who are you writing to? Who is your ideal audience? Do you do one piece for one kind of audience and another piece for another kind of audience? Who's not the right audience? Who's the right audience? Those kind of questions.
The right kind of audience is an audience. I just want one. So I'm not too picky on those regards. I'm a lucky guy. I have a reasonable amount of my work is written on commission. So the venue and the location sometimes determine form for me. Is it more like a play or is it more like a piece? Those have internal structural rules to me. They don't have a hierarchy of what's better or not. But they have different rules and relate to what might be more recognizable in certain places to certain audiences, or more permissible. But I do not assume that my audience loves the detritus that I worship, so I try to, I do make work that talks to an audience. It is theater, it's for an audience. I try to think about them, I try to talk to them. I don't do the fourth wall. I don't understand that fourth wall, pretending the audience is there, isn't there. In this day and age, I just can't do it. I don't understand it. So I hope my work all talks directly to the audience and is about talking to the audience. That said, I usually have some political axe to grind encoded somewhere in the work, but usually in the story that I have found, the fragment that is enticing me, is that political axe, and it is usually, as you were saying, a mirror of something that is happening now that I'd like to talk about through past precedent.
So I feel like it's a real privilege being an American historian in the United States. Must be like being a French historian in France, where what people like me do should be important to those who vote and those who ought to. It's also a privilege working in a discipline that does not have to require an arcane language. I'm not a chemist, right, where you have to do, you know, 8 years of a sequence of fundamental chemistry in order to read what I write. So I think American historians have a civic duty to speak to people who aren't other PhD-holding American historians, which I think of as an opening up rather than a dumbing down. You know, this is our story, and it's stories of different and contested we's. And historians are lucky that way. We don't do anything fancy. We just tell, it's been going on for thousands of years, right? We just tell stories, and the national story ought to be important to all of us because we act on it every day.
I think audiences are extraordinarily important because, as I said, I'm making work to be part of a discussion. Oftentimes, and the clearer I am about the audience, and anyway, there's this term authenticating audience, and the clearer I am about the audience that when she or he sees the work and responds to the work, then that actually propels me to finish what I need to do, because I know that there's somebody there that's waiting. So audience is key, but and the funding sometimes, if it's a commission work, will sort of determine where it might go. But I also try to keep that kind of cultural work perspective that who needs this work, and that's empowering to me.
Jane, when you were working on your novel, did you feel obligated to tell your reader in some way, your readers, when something was imagined versus so-called factual?
We had a website that did that. I mean, as a novelist, I felt completely free to lie. That was why that was one of the reasons for doing it. In terms of audience, one of the things that writing the novel opened up that I had not fully experienced as a scholar, but now I'm trying to hang on to, is readers who are engaged by passion, which you must see in your viewerships all the time. Readers who would come to readings and say things like, "Where is she now?" I have this laptop and there's a folder that was moved from my desktop deeper into, what do you mean, where is she now? And that would also come without some of the basic building blocks that a second year college student would have. Like, people had sex in the 18th century, I don't think that's true. Or there was slavery in the North, you made that up. So it was an opportunity for for both a more emotionally resonant and a differently educative kind of conversation than I had in scholarly work, and I found it very, very nourishing in both of those ways. So I want to hang on to passion, and I guess the thing I've taken forward into scholarship is, I think scholars have a way so here's what we're afraid of. We're afraid of telling you something you already know. This is trained into us very hard. Don't we already know that? What's new? What's new here? I don't think we should be afraid of that. I think if we know that our reader needs some tool to move the machine forward, then we have to give them the tool, or it's insulting. So that was something that writing the novel taught me to be unafraid of.
For me, history is. his story, her story, its story. That's one thing. Another thing is, the second that I have a thought, it's now history. Therefore, for me, history and the future are one and the same, because history conditions the future, and the future conditions the history. Also, you all are selling something up there, every one of you. How can you separate yourselves from that idea of selling something to presenting something that is based in something that has something other than selling as a basis? And then for you in the middle, Jane, you've written a novel. Now you're writing about Copley. Mm-hmm. Are you going to lie to us?
I'm not going to lie to you.
Just to be the selling thing, I mean, that goes back to, though, to me, how history was kept. History, no history was kept without wishing someone to know something. Selling is part of imparting, selling, preserving. These are all related things. Can you out the politics of that is the question.
And I guess I need to better understand selling. I see it, the work as sharing and also taking something back. But oftentimes, unfortunately, if we're talking about selling in a very literal sense, I mean, it's not about money exchange. But I think it's a sharing, and I think that, at least from my vantage point.
I have a question about what do you do if security is involved? Let me give you an example. I'm writing a non-traditional story, a history of a church. And it's just like the kind of things you're writing about in many ways. It's not the usual puff up and, you know, glorious and isn't everything great kind of thing. It's the actual records of the people in the church. But one of the members of the church many, many, many years ago gave a very, very, very expensive chalice to the church with diamonds and 18 karat gold and all this kind of thing. His records of giving that plus a $15,000 insurance policy went on for a couple of years is there. Now, what I know what I did, but what would you do so as to help the church not have people knocking on the door, sneaking in?
Is the chalice relevant to the history?
Yeah, it's used regularly in the worship service. It's part of the nature of the church in terms of Victorian era church. It kind of explains how they, you know, have so many things there, kind of thing. But my question is, what do you do if what you find out is a security risk? That's my general question.
I mean, it's common in writing about works of art that are located in private homes to just say private collection. And that's a kind of, you know, not to draw a map. I mean, I would assume that in your case, the church will have an answer for this, right? Don't they? They have some way of securing it? That's tough. That's tough.
What I did with it was, in the document, which named how why he gave it and under his wife and so did not include one of the ones, just put that, and did not include his wife's name or his name. Is that what you would do if you found something? I mean,
It's, as she says, to me, it would totally depend on what is the meat of the story and what is the why. What have I decided to try and show? And I have never quite run up against this problem, so I can't tell you what I would do. I know that I have turned away sometimes in the process of investigating stuff while I was still open enough to say, this looks like I don't want to deal with how this can or can't be told, so let me see if I can go to something else and get out what I want to get out.
thanks, guys, for coming. Your insights have been really insightful tonight. Use that all in one phrase. My background is in journalism, and so I know as a journalist, we're dealing with facts that are happening in the here and now, and we kind of like know how, I know how to professionally deal with bias in that area. So I was really fascinated, and when you guys were talking about that red line and what to do and what not to include, but you know, you guys are historians, and you become like the world's greatest bookies, where you kind of already know the score of everything that you're covering. Talk to me about how you guys are able to filter out your own personal feelings. You guys, whatever you publish or you're able to put out, you're looking at this at even on a more minute timeline, where you're able to probably feel at some point that, wow, like, you know, I can see where this person is about to make a really stupid mistake, mm-hmm. or I'm really mad that they did that, you know, because I know that 30 years later, they really pushed back the cause. Can you talk about how you approach trying to avoid that bias in all of your work and what is ultimately published?
I think that you definitely have to first be clear about your perspective, bias, whatever. What your position is relative to the material and the story that you're trying to tell. I think personally, one has to have some faith in truth, and that the truth, no matter how much it may not please you personally, but if it's relevant to the story, then by presenting those truth, and truth is a hard thing to define, of course, but by presenting that truth, that there's actually power, and the difficulties or the uncomfortableness of that truth, if it's relevant to it, is worth presenting, because that's your work. And one of the problems about lies or things that you know not to be the truth is that you really can't build a film. You can't build narrative. You can't build analysis on like on a bad foundation. Then you have to do so much kind of jerry rigging to hold up your narrative story. I don't know if that. Yeah, if that makes sense.
I want to offer two answers. So I, thinking about this question this week, I think one, of course, thinks about the Columbia Journalism School's review of the Rolling Stone article. And the kind of bias they uncovered is a kind of bias that I think we all have to be careful of all the time. And that's what an investor or a game theory person would call confirmation bias. You find what you think you're going to find, and you become unwilling to listen to the static that suggests that you're tuning wrong to the station. So thinking about confirmation bias all the time seems really important, and thinking about a process of discovery and inquiry rather than sort of lining up the dots of the story you think you were going to know. I guess my other answer to the other kind of bias is revision. You know, that there are times when I can't hear it in my head until I read it, and then I go back. And a place that I'm wrestling with right now is one of the things I've discovered in my research is that Copley, who is in many ways a lovable character in the way that a cactus is lovable, a very American character, you know, an aspirer against the odds, continually thwarted. So I've discovered that he was also a slave owner. And he was, in that way, a creature of his time. About 10% of Bostonians were slaveholders. There's something particularly repugnant about his slaveholding in that slaveholding was not economically useful to an artisan in Boston, it was decorative. So you couldn't even say this was the economic system of his time and he was a participant in it. It's very volitional. So in writing this part of his life, I'm livid. And I am a thing that a biographer does not is not entitled to be. I'm disappointed in him. You know, he didn't live to edify me. He's not capable of disappointing me. He's not my child. And I think the only way I'm going to be able to tell that story fully and richly and truly but not angrily is on third and fourth draft when I think about, oh, how does being furious with him here still square with when he triumphs or when he's in tragedy? You know, it's all part of the same more or less coherent human being. So that to me is a revision for bias, if you will, or a revision for a kind of personalizing that can be constructive and destructive at the same time.
And just my little short answer is, in terms of the confirming bias thing, my problem is that essentially I do have to construct a person who will speak at some point. And somewhere in that story, who knows which character it is within there. And the way I can usually do that is I have to kind of fall in love a little bit. And I kind of have to have this sort of platonic affair. And that means that if I'm lucky, that their faults, because everybody has faults and everybody does bad things, that their faults and their bad things are ones that I can understand or could imagine I might do sometime or have done. The few times that they go so far into that place, which has luckily not happened to me a lot, one way to solve them is I out my presence. Mm-hmm. And I out my presence and out the fact that I can't cleanse this moment of my opinion. So here it is. Now let's go back.
I had I did some research on George Washington and his household here in Philadelphia. And I had an experience similar to yours with Copley, where Washington's secretary...
So much worse, Washington.
But I mean, for years, I was reading Washington's secretary's letters to get background information and such. And I didn't know that he later committed suicide. And when I did find out, I had a real emotional experience, and it was very surprising. But one thing about the president's house, it brings to mind myth versus historical fact, and what the mixture should be and how you deal with it when myth takes over and becomes the narrative rather than the historical fact.
And I also have a relationship with the President's House story and project, and try to create a visualization of the lives of 9 enslaved Africans that George and Martha Washington brought to Philadelphia in that period between 1790 and 1797. I'm not sure about myth. I mean, I think that in working in documentary and working, you know, purely scripted, purely narratively, working with actors or as opposed to working with document and actuality, to me they're different animals, and what I But looking at the sort of historical power of that, the narrative work, the scripted work, I think it has to still be based in fact, in document, as opposed to being based in myth. And that's the first level. And then the second level is, at some point, having to believe in historians, having to trust people who have spent their lives researching materials and who have gathered evidence. And sometimes historians may not agree, but trying to use your rational powers and say, well, based on this sort of presentation, that is how we will construct this scripted narrative. So.
Sometimes people would really rather believe the myth, however. And as somebody who studied Benjamin Franklin a great deal and wrote about him and created exhibitions, and somebody who believes that the folks who produced the 50-volume papers of Benjamin Franklin and who have spent 50 years working on the subject and who have not ever been able to uncover a shred of evidence that Benjamin Franklin was unfaithful to his wife, or that he had any children out of wedlock once he was married. He did have a child before he was married, okay? But people will not believe me when I say that. People prefer the myth over the work of many, many historians over many, many decades.
And this is not to value error, but I would just say that where I live, which is maybe not an entirely popular answer, myth and fact are like semi-detached houses. They are not separate. They do not live separately. They bleed into each other all the time, and part of the creating of a history that's history cannot be the story of everything that happened. It's not possible. Something made it and something didn't. The reason there is a whole field of revised history is because historians are constantly finding new information which makes them go back through everything and recalibrate. So I'm interested in how those two engines of keeping information, myth, emotion, history, how those engines are twinned. Nostalgia, I have a problem with, but that's different.
Yeah, I guess our myths do cultural work, and a lot of that cultural work really blinds us, keeps us shackled to the past in ways that we don't want to be. So I tend to be very skeptical of it. And yet, I think demythologizing by itself is not enough, right? Like the Mythbusters answer, you know, aha! We caught him. You know, it's back to Louis is revealing the private life in and of itself to get that gotcha enough, unless you have some other story that you want to build up. So I think the story many of us as historians want to build up now is George Washington, freedom fighter and slaveholder. Not George Washington, not freedom fighter because slaveholder, but a world in which these things went together. How do we understand that world? And can that be a complicated story that is satisfying enough to replace that myth? The myth is really filling, right? You can't just replace it with a green smoothie because people will be hungry. So I guess I'm interested in the, If that's a veil that we need to tear away for our present and our future and our past, what are we going to put in its place that is equally satisfying? But can I say one more thing? If a woman doesn't ask a question before this is over, I'm going to have failed as a human being.
Juana.
So this question is a bit more juvenile. I was wondering how, as a third grade teacher, and I always think back to my history experiences, and I think back when I was in school and how I really didn't like history. And I think that for younger children, I think that the time factor is really, really difficult for them to understand. They just don't have the concept of, they didn't live in the time period. Most of their experiences don't impact them, so they don't understand it. So how do you begin to teach children time so that they can start to look at the setting and how all of those things play a factor?
That's a great question, and we should all kneel before you. You're doing the real work. I'm flashing back to a time that I taught my son's first grade class, and I thought they're great visual learners, and they can see better than they can do anything else. So I brought in these cartoons from cartoons done in the early 1500s of Europeans drawing Indians. And asked them to just talk about what they saw. And the girls said these amazingly perceptive things. It's like a supermarket. It's like the person who's drawing this is thinking about all the stuff they can take. And the boys said, I see their butts. I don't know. I think, like, things that they can see, touch, you got to know when enough is. Like, to maybe you know far more about child development than I do, but sensing difference is the first way to sense something in time.
I have they're older, they're high school, but I've been doing a program in New York called the Urban Memory Project, which does like neighborhood histories in high schools with high school kids. And the very first one we did it was in Bushwick. This is maybe eight years ago when Bushwick was really on the edge of a lot of things. And Bushwick was settled by, was a German enclave at the turn of the century and a well-to-do one. And I went in and did what I knew would bore the kids. I showed them 40 minutes of like, here's a picture, this is down, you recognize this? This is 100 years ago right outside the school. There's the school, this is the trees, this is the house across the street, this is this. I showed them all these things, and they were getting more and more bored, and at the end of it I said, okay, so this was all Germans, are there any Germans here now? No. This was all rich houses, are there any rich houses here now? No. This was like this, is there any trees across the street? No. That's right, all of it is gone, no one knows about it, and you're next. It worked.
I work at a place called Scribe Video Center where we teach people how to use film and video and audio and as means of personal expression. And we have a very active youth history project. Each year we give about 12 young people a topic, and they're supposed to look at that topic over time. So last year was the history of poetry in Philadelphia, of spoken word and poetry in Philadelphia. And so, and my hope was, you know, they would go back to, you know, the 19th century, go back to the 18th century. But again, I'm working with middle and high school students. Their idea of history is they're going back to, you know, 2010 or yeah, 2000, you know, and I mean, I don't even know the hip hop artists from like the 1990s, but that to them is like ancient history. And so initially I'm like in pain because I really want them to look at, you know, Francis Watkins, you know, I want them to go back, but we do that. But I also realize that because of their shorter span of history, I've learned to appreciate that their comprehensive knowledge of the last 7 years is actually something rich and worth exploring. And so that even though I can't necessarily pull them back all the time, I do value their, you know, the insights that they bring to the recent past.
This has been a really great conversation, and I appreciate all of you being part of it. You identified yourself as a teacher. If there are other teachers, as well as you, who are interested in Act 48 credits for this program, Would you see Beth, who's in the back, who's waving her hand with the orange shirt? She can help you with that. And we do hope that you'll continue to follow this series of programs. And the next event is May 13th, and you can read more about it in the program. Again, thank you all for coming.